Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Trish reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Tuesday, April 7th, 2020. Coronavirus. MMH recommends wearing cloth face masks by Caitlin Randall. CRANDLE at MRT.com. Everyone in the community should wear cloth masks in public to prevent the spread of coronavirus by asymptomatic carriers, Midland Memorial Hospital officials said Monday. They estimated that 20% or more of the population could be asymptomatic carriers of the virus. Hospital officials' recommendations came after the CDC issued guidelines Friday that cloth face coverings should be worn in public places where social distancing is difficult to maintain, such as in grocery stores and pharmacies. Midland Memorial CEO Russell Myers said cloth masks will not prevent someone from being infected by the virus because the aerosolized particles from an infected person are microscopic and can travel through openings in the mask. Cloth coverings can, however, prevent further spread of the virus. The purpose of the new CDC guidelines, which we'll be implementing here in the hospital, is not so much to protect the person wearing the mask, he said. But the masks will protect anyone from aerosolized droplets that could come from a COVID patient's cough or sneeze. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Larry Wilson agreed the masks are intended to protect the rest of the population from asymptomatic carriers. If I'm standing up here and I cough or sneeze, it'll blend the distribution of my water droplets into the air around me. So I am, by virtue of wearing a mask, protecting the people that I'm around when I'm in a public environment. Wilson said grocery stores and other retailers are the ideal places to wear these masks, as customers in those places are not practicing proper social distancing. I want to emphasize there are people with this virus in our community that don't know that they have it. I promise you that that's true right now, and we are spreading it amongst ourselves if we're not really, really careful with that. Additionally, he said MMH has expanded the criteria for testing patients at their drive-through location. He said they were originally testing only residents with a respiratory tract illness and a fever who had traveled to a high-risk area or been on a cruise ship, but they are now testing more broadly. We're looking more widely for the disease in the community rather than just looking at people that have either been into a high-risk area or had known contact with somebody positive for COVID-19, he said. The following is a letter written by our mayor, Mayor Patrick Payton. We must be our neighbor's keeper. Dear fellow Midlanders, as we all continue to adjust to the challenges we are facing with the coronavirus and the crashing economy, I am repeatedly brought back to the writings of four authors I have treasured in my life. Those four are, in historical and chronological order, the Apostle James, Viktor Frankl, Stephen Covey, and Dr. Edith Eva Eger. Allow me a brief minute to explain. Each author writes from the perspective that hard and difficult and even unfair circumstances are to be expected in life. It's not for us to find a way to escape hard times, but rather for us to choose how we will respond in tough and difficult times. Every author I have mentioned above says the same thing with their own personal twist. Every author seeks to communicate that it is not what happens to you, what is demanded of you, or what is taken from you that matters the most. What matters the most is the choice that you make in response to what is happening to you and around you. It is tempting in these difficult, restrictive, and frightening days to respond selfishly, fearfully, and dangerously. But in these difficult days, each one of us has the chance to respond with a bigger view of life and the lives of those around us. Every convenience and comfort of our old normal life are being challenged and stripped away. Though we are certain this is but for a season, we wonder how long the season will last. But regardless of the length of the season, the bigger question is how we will choose to respond. Will we choose to sacrifice and serve, or will we choose anger, selfishness, and fear that neglects the higher calling to serve others and chooses joy in spite of the circumstance? The unseen fear of a new virus is causing great fear and uncertainty. The unforeseen calamity of the oil and gas market is destroying our economy. The combined forces of viral uncertainty and economic collapse are combining to create a perfect storm of worry and anxiety. But through all this, each one of us still possesses the power to choose our response. We can choose to sacrifice and serve, or we can choose to be selfish and dangerous. I believe each one of us knows the higher calling and will readily accept it. There will be those who refuse to sacrifice and serve, but if the majority choose the value of service and sacrifice toward and for others, it will negate the minority. Rather than waiting to see what civil liberty has to be taken away for the safety and security of our neighbor, let us voluntarily relinquish our rights in order to sacrifice and serve for the greater good and well-being of our neighbors. We are our neighbor's keeper. Stay at home and stay safe. Housing. Report. Rent in Midland drops 11.7% in March. Odessa rents decreased 10.4%, according to Online Apartment Guide, by Stuart Doreen, S. Doreen at HearstNP.com. The impact of the oil downturn on the apartment rents in Midland and Odessa continued in March, according to a report from Rent Cafe. The online guide to the nation's apartment industry reported that the average rent in Midland dropped 11.7% year over year during the month of March. In Odessa, the average rent dropped 10.4%. Midland and Odessa not only rank as the communities with the largest drops in the nation, but also are the only communities with drops larger than 2.5%. In Midland, the average rent fell to $1,433 in March, down from $1,452 in February and $1,490 at the beginning of the year. The website also reports the average rent has dropped $100 a month since October and $174 since June, when rent for the average apartment reached $1,607. Rent Cafe also noted that Midland displayed a 14.9% annual growth rate in average rent last year. Average apartment rents in Odessa are now $1,268, following a 10.4% yearly decrease and a 1.4% decline compared to February. Similarly, the city's rents have entered a steep decline since March 2019, when the yearly growth was 13%. The decrease is accelerating compared to February as well. Rent Cafe noted in a release, Midland's yearly change was 10.3% in February, while Odessa's was down 7%. Midland also moved down one spot to number 3 across the state. The Woodlands, located outside of Houston, has the top average rent in the state at $1,458, according to Rent Cafe. Austin took over the number 2 spot from Midland with a monthly rent of $1,445. Metroplex suburbs Frisco and Richardson also showed average rents above $1,400, $1,428 and $1,402 respectively. Across the nation, Rent Cafe reports an average apartment rent of $1,474 in March, up $42 since last year, according to apartment data from Yardi Matrix. The following are March rents and month-over-month percentage growth from around the state and nation, according to Rent Cafe's blog. Largest month-over-month drops across the nation: Midland, 11.7%, Odessa, 10.4%, Providence, Rhode Island, 2%, Boulder, Colorado, 1.9%, Sugar Land, Texas, 1.5%. Highest rents during the month of March in Texas: the Woodlands, $1,458, Austin, $1,445, Midland, $1,433, Frisco, $1,428, Richardson, $1,402, Plano, $1,364, Sugar Land, $1,347, Pearland, $1,345, McKinney, $1,301, Odessa, $1,268. Rents from the largest cities in Texas: Austin, $1,445, Dallas, $1,254, Fort Worth, $1,130, Houston, $1,120, San Antonio, $1,055, El Paso, $789. Energy. Oil producers race for output deal. G20 Energy Ministers Plan Emergency Meeting, by Javier Blaze and Henry Meyer of Bloomberg. Saudi Arabia, Russia, and other OPEC plus nations are racing to negotiate a deal to stem the historic oil price crash, with the G20 taking center stage to bring into the fold the U.S. and other energy producers. U.S. Energy Secretary Dan Brugliette held a productive discussion over the phone with his Saudi counterpart, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman. The government said a further sign that the diplomatic talks continue apace. The talks still face significant obstacles. A meeting of producers from OPEC Plus and beyond, which has been delayed once already, is only tentatively scheduled for Thursday. Russia and Saudi Arabia want the U.S. to join in, but President Donald Trump has so far shown little willingness to do so as part of a deal between the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies. As an alternative, oil diplomats are planning an emergency meeting of G20 energy ministers for Friday, part of an effort to bring the U.S. and other big oil producers outside the OPEC alliance, such as Canada and Brazil, on board, according to two people familiar with the situation. Brugliette said on Monday that Washington was going to encourage the Saudis as chair of the G20 to perhaps convene an energy ministerial toward the end of the week as a forum to discuss the oil market. I expect that's going to happen later this week. Crude prices have fallen 50% this year as the economic effects of the coronavirus pandemic have knocked out about a third of global demand. The price crash is so dramatic that it is threatening the stability of oil-dependent nations and the existence of U.S. shale producers, as well as posing an extra challenge to central banks. Industry officials say that if a deal to cut supply in an orderly way isn't reached, the market will simply force producers to slash output as storage space runs out. The aim of talks, first revealed by Trump last week, is to cut oil production by about 10%, the biggest ever coordinated reduction. Crude rallied on Trump's comments, but pared those gains as the diplomatic intricacies became clearer. Brent futures fell 2% on Monday, trading near $33 a barrel. Russia and Saudi Arabia are very, very close to reaching a deal on oil production cuts. Kirill Dmitriev, chief executive officer of the Russian Direct Investment Fund, said in an interview with CNBC. However, if a deal is struck for as much as 10 million barrels per day, that will barely dent the supply glut, which is estimated at as much as 35 million barrels a day. In some corners of the physical market, prices have already turned negative, and traders have been putting oil into tankers at a record pace to store it at sea. Saudi Arabia and Russia both say they want the U.S., which has become the world's largest producer thanks to its shale revolution, to join the cuts. But Trump had only hostile words for OPEC on Saturday, threatening tariffs on foreign oil, though at a briefing late Sunday, he said he didn't expect to have to use them. The G20 may be an easier forum for the U.S. to embrace than OPEC. If the Americans don't take part, the problem which existed before for the Russians and Saudis will remain, that they cut output while the U.S. ramps it up, and that makes the whole thing impossible, said Fyodor Lukyanov, head of the Council on Foreign and Defensive Policy, a research group that advises the Kremlin. It's not clear if Russia and Saudi Arabia will require the U.S. to publicly commit to cut production, a challenge in the private fragmented American industry, or if a compromise gesture would be enough. Alexander Dinkin, president of the Institute of World Economy and International Relations in Moscow, a state-run think tank, said Moscow would like the U.S. to lift some sanctions as a compromise. Even a passive role for the American shale industry, whose output is already expected to go into decline at current prices, may be enough for a deal, said Jason Bordoff, director of the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University and a former oil official at the White House. Russia and Saudi Arabia's condition that they will only cut production if the U.S. does too is going to be satisfied because market forces will drive U.S. output down around 1 million barrels a day this year, said Bordoff. Russia and Saudi Arabia, which sparred publicly between themselves over the weekend, have disagreed about how they would calculate the cuts, according to a person familiar with the talks. Russia favors using an average of the first quarter output as the baseline, while Saudi Arabia wants to use its current April production. The difference is huge. The kingdom pumped 9.8 million barrels a day on average between January and March. In April, as it wages its battle for market share, it's producing more than 12 million. Any agreement will require diplomatic agility at a time when nations are devoting massive resources to fighting the pandemic itself. All three players, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and President Trump, appeared to be maneuvering to avoid blame if talks fail. Yet the U.S. president has also said he's confident there will be an agreement between Moscow and Riyadh to cut production. The chances of a meaningful deal that delivers real production cuts are low, but back-channel talks are ongoing, said Amitra Sen, chief oil analyst and consultant at Energy Aspects Limited. Mohammed bin Salman is under heavy political pressure from Trump to demonstrate the kingdom isn't trying to bankrupt the U.S. shale industry. Coronavirus briefs from staff reports. Ector County records confirmed case number 30. The Ector County Health Department has confirmed four more positive coronavirus cases, bringing the total to 30 cases, according to the ECHD website. The age range of patients with the new cases is 36 to 59. There have been 112 tests come back negative, 55 tests are pending, and 197 people have been tested in Ector County. During a Zoom video press conference, Medical Center Health System President and CEO Russell Tippin said they have tested 14 positive patients, and of those, 5 patients are in the hospital and 4 are in critical care on ventilators. MCH has had 73 negatives and 14 pending cases. Odessa Medical Regional Center President and CEO Stacy Brown said they have tested 75 patients. Of those, 9 have tested positive and 60 have tested negative, with 6 tests still pending. 5 patients are currently under investigation at ORMC. 2 patients at ORMC are confirmed positive coronavirus patients and are on ventilators. Midlands Health Department reports 1 case on Monday. The number of coronavirus cases rose by 1 in Midland County on Monday, as the City of Midlands Health Department reported 1 new confirmed case. The 27th confirmed case is a male in his 40s, tested by Midland Health, according to the city. The male has been self-isolating at home, and his source of exposure is contact to known case, the city reported. It was the 27th reported case in Midland County, but statistics show the number of cases trail what is being reported in other larger population counties in West Texas. The following is what was reported Monday. 154 in Lubbock County, 76 in the counties where Amarillo resides, 31 in Taylor County, Abilene, and 30 cases in Ector County, according to the Texas Department of State Health Services. Wilson. All MMH employees exposed to coronavirus test negative. All Midland Memorial Hospital employees who have had a known exposure to the novel coronavirus have been tested and the results were negative, Chief Medical Officer Larry Wilson said Monday. About 30 employees were exposed by the first person in Midland County to test positive for the virus before the hospital suspected he had COVID-19, CEO Russell Myers said previously. Wilson said Monday, the test results for those employees were received recently and all employees tested negative. The results took about 2 weeks to come back because of a delay with a lab vendor, he said. The hospital has since switched to a new vendor and has been receiving results within 24 to 48 hours. Wilson said there were 3 employees who developed symptoms of COVID-19 and self-quarantined. Those employees were retested and again tested negative, he said. They are now past their quarantine periods. P&Z defers consideration of new apartment complex by Mella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Adapting to shelter-in-place desires amid the COVID-19 outbreak, Planning and Zoning Commissioners held a virtual meeting Monday, beaming into cyberspace from the City Council chambers in City Hall. Dominating discussion was a request by Maverick Engineering for a zone change from PD, Planned District, for an office center to PD, Planned Development District, for a housing development on the site at Corporate Drive and North Big Spring Street. After initially making a motion to approve the request, the commissioners then reversed course and voted unanimously to defer consideration until its next meeting, April 20th, when it can hear directly from the applicant. Maverick Engineering proposes building a 295,000-square-foot multifamily complex of 124 units at a vacant lot at 45 Corporate Drive. The developer said it would offer affordable housing and housing for seniors. A debate occurred as to how the developers would guarantee that the housing would be for seniors and be affordable. Then commissioners were told the plans did not meet minimum standards for storage or for parking. "I don't want there to be parking problems down the road," said Commissioner Chase Gardoff. "Seniors may need less parking, but what if the complex is sold and there's not a significant number of seniors to fill the development? Then you start having families moving in and they could have a 16-year-old with a car and work trucks and things like that, and suddenly people will be parking on the street and having nowhere to park, and I don't want that to be an issue." Commission Chair Josh Sparks said the same with storage. Commissioner Reggie Lawrence said it would be easy for the commission to approve the request, but this is an opportunity to set a precedent. "When you bring up topics like storage and parking spaces, possibly it could set up a precedent to suggest we attempt to make the best efforts toward what we do. Uphold ordinances and set that baseline of let's talk about this first." Commissioners also approved requests for specific use designations with term for the sale of all alcoholic beverages, 2 for new restaurants and 1 for an existing restaurant that wants to expand its service hours, and 1 for a bar at the Courtyard Marriott on Tradewinds Boulevard. Cork and Pig Tavern, Ally Village, LLC, received approval for its request for its new Cork and Pig Tavern to be established at 200 Spring Park Drive in the Ally Village development, Spring Park and Big Spring Street. The new restaurant will be 3,900 square feet with an occupancy for 89. Service hours will be 11 to 10, Monday through Thursday, 11 to 11, Friday and Saturday, and 11 to 9 on Sundays. Commissioners approved the request by Garrett Haley for a new Blue Sky Burgers restaurant at West Loop 250 and Midkiff. With all the uncertainty around the restaurant industry right now, Haley asked how long the approval would last before he would have to reapply, and he was told it would be 120 days. Midland Platinum received an approval for its request for a permit for consumption of alcohol in a bar located on the first floor of the Courtyard by Marriott at 1505 Tradewinds Boulevard to serve alcohol from 4 p.m. to midnight daily. City staff changed the occupancy load from 218 to 439, with 150 in their main bar area, 89 in an outdoor area, and 200 in meeting room areas. Brew Street Bakery at 4610 Garfield Street, which offers craft beers and wine, filed its request in order to expand its hours to 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Wednesday, 10 to 11 Thursday through Saturday, and 10 to 10 on Sunday. Commissioners also unanimously approved a request by Midland King DTP LLC for a zone change from LI, Light Industrial, to C, Commercial District, on 2 lots at Garden City Highway and King Street. Bob Gage with DTP Realty told the commissioners his company plans to build a Dollar General store on the 1.05-acre site at 2410 Garden City Highway. In other action, commissioners approved a request by Maverick Engineering for a zone change from PD Plan District for housing development to an amended PD at Chukar Lane and Beechwood Street. Commissioners were told a new plot line had been adapted for the next phase of development in that subdivision, consisting of 115 lots with a new setback of 25 feet from the property line. A residential replat of 2 lots at West Estes Avenue and North Marienfeld Street, combining them into a single lot. A request by Elvira Garcia for a zone change from RR, Regional Retail, to SF3, Single Family Dwelling, on 2 lots at South Baird and East Pennsylvania Avenue, to allow for construction of single family homes. a request by Jorge Chavez for a similar zone change request from MF22, multiple family dwelling, to SF3 on a lot at North Adams Street and East Illinois Avenue to allow for construction of single family home. Christy Craddock requests delay in production tax collections. By Mella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. A year ago, the state's energy industry paid more than $14 billion in state and local taxes and made more than $2 billion in state royalty payments. But this year promises to be radically different, as the industry is suffering from collapsing oil prices caused by the demand destruction of the coronavirus and flooding the market with crude by Saudi Arabia and Russia. These are most unusual times, Railroad Commissioner Christy Craddock said in a phone interview. That's why she sent a letter Monday to Comptroller Glenn Hager requesting that he extend the deadline to file monthly crude oil and natural gas production taxes. What we've worked on in my office is to see all things we can do to help the industry and help people everywhere. We've worked on waivers of all kinds. We have lots of waivers in place to give companies time to file things. She said she asked the comptroller to give companies additional time to pay the production taxes to give them flexibility, just as he did with franchise taxes. It wouldn't be out of line for him to do it. Her request is for the monthly deadline to be extended 3 to 6 months so that companies wouldn't have their taxes deducted from their mineral payments, as is traditionally done, and those taxes are held in trust to be sent to the state comptroller's office. Craddock stressed that companies would still have to pay those taxes, but they would have additional time. And the funds that would go to taxes could instead be used to help companies pay bills or make payrolls and retain employees. Anything that lets companies pay their people, keep their employees, let people keep their jobs is important to me. She also requested that the comptroller review standards in place for real property interest in oil to determine if his office can offer guidance to reduce the likelihood of massive mineral appraisal protests. Any opportunity or idea to help the industry, especially if they're small operators, any opportunities for them to have flexibility. The native Midlander, first elected to the Railroad Commission in 2012, is also preparing for the April 14th hearing to consider the request by Parsley Energy and Pioneer Natural Resources that the agency determine reasonable market demand for Texas crude. The move could lead to commissioners pro-rationing state output for the first time in 50 years. I hope it will be a vibrant hearing with lots of comments, whether by letter or online, she said. She said she hopes to hear the perspectives of the industry, economists, academics, and statisticians on the subject. This is a major shift in the conversation after 50 years. It's not an easy conversation. All parts of the industry will be affected. I hope they give us their perspectives. She said she had conversations with her peers in Canada and with the federal government about the need to reduce production. Texas can't do it alone. It needs to be all states. This is an opinion from the Dallas Morning News. Guest view, universal COVID-19 testing would be good for economy. I'm not an epidemiologist, neither is Larry Kotlikoff. He's an economist and professor at Boston University. His work has been featured in many of my columns. We've written 3 books together. That happened because I admired his part in creating generational accounting. Larry called a few days ago. It wasn't to talk generational accounting or the problems facing Social Security or the future burdens we're putting on our kids, our usual topics. No, he called to say why we need universal and repeated testing for COVID-19. You can read what he's written on the subject in his recent Forbes column. Neither of us has studied epidemiology, but we do know a bit about math, and the underlying discipline is basically the same. Here's the problem. We may need to test people seeking hospital admission because they feel they have COVID-19, but that testing is only for hospital admission purposes. It only serves to admit those with the virus. It puts everyone else back into circulation, so admission testing serves no broad purpose. The people asking for the test have already self-identified as having the virus. Many will have it, some won't. It leaves all the rest of us in circulation, including the many people who have the virus and not know it. If we want to knock back the virus without croaking our economy, we need to do more than social distancing. We need proactive identification of those with the virus. Indeed, universal and regular testing for COVID-19 may be the way to avoid a recurrence of the pandemic. Universal testing would allow us all to get back to work again, and it would have to cost a ridiculous amount not to be worth doing. It would be good for the economy, and it would be good for our minds and hearts. Think about the difference. Without universal testing, we can only slow the virus from spreading by staying home. With universal and repeated testing, most people could go about their regular lives. That would include work. Only those who tested positive would be taken out of circulation to self-quarantine or be hospitalized. In the long hangover period after the coming death peak, we need to ramp up for regular and near-universal testing. It can be done. Iceland is doing it now. According to NBC News, Iceland has tested a far greater proportion of its population than anywhere else on Earth, including South Korea. It's also testing thousands of ordinary members of its general population who aren't showing symptoms. Scott Burns, Dallas Morning News. Obituaries for Tuesday, April 7th, 2020. Harold W. Dumas. Harold W. Dumas, 87, of Midland, passed away Thursday, April 2nd, 2020, in Midland. Graveside services are scheduled for 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 7th, at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Harold is survived by wife, Donna Dumas, of Midland, son, Mike Dumas, Tanya, of Junction, daughter, Shelley Dumas, of Midland, grandsons, Hayden Dumas, of Orinsky Falls, New York, Ryan Holt, of Lubbock, and Colby Holt, of Junction. Harold is preceded in death by his parents and his brother, Billy. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Jerry Reese. Jerry Reese, 79, passed away on April 4th, 2020, surrounded by his loving family. Family and friends may pay respects 8 a.m. until 6 p.m. Wednesday, April 8th, at Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematorium, Midland. A private burial will be held at Rest Haven Memorial Park due to current guidelines prohibiting large gatherings. A live stream of the graveside service will be available at 1 p.m. on Thursday at livestream.com/NPW. The family will schedule a celebration of life service at a later date. Jerry was born on March 4th, 1941, in Wink, Texas. Jerry is survived by his loving wife, Jackie, stepdaughters Nancy Cunningham List, her husband Frank of Smyrna, Tennessee, Kathy Cunningham McCollum, and her husband Tawny of Midland, nephews Mike Reese and his wife Nong of Houston, Texas, and David Reese of Amarillo. He is preceded in death by both parents and five siblings. The family suggests memorials be donated to Hospice of Midland, the American Cancer Society, or First Tee of Texas. Death notices. Janet Y. Davidson. Janet Y. Davidson, 88, of Midland, Texas, passed away on Sunday, April 5th, 2020. The family will have private services at a later date. She is survived by her nephews, Donald Cawthon and Robbie Davidson, great-niece Tiffany Waters, and great-nephew Blake Cawthon. John Gary McPherson. John Gary McPherson, 82, of Midland, passed away Saturday, April 4th, surrounded by his family. Public viewing will be at 8 a.m. until 9 p.m. Wednesday, April 8th, at Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. Thursday, April 9th, 2020, at the Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Due to current restrictions on gathering, the service will be streamed live at livestream.com/NPW. Burial will follow in Rest Haven Memorial Park, which will also be provided via live stream. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, April 7th, 2020, front page. County plans for COVID-19. Coliseum would be base for mass testing. By Bob Campbell, B-C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L at OAOA.com. After a discussion with health professionals, Ector County Commissioners Monday voted to proceed with emergency COVID-19 related planning to include mass testing at the Ector County Coliseum. As yet lacking a vaccine for the potentially deadly respiratory ailment, the commissioners and health pros agreed that testing and encouraging the public to abide by U.S. Centers for Disease Control guidelines was about all they could do in response to the pandemic. Dr. Timothy Benton, Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs at Texas Tech Health Sciences Center, said the health crisis is challenging everyone. This virus has changed all of our lives, Benton said, noting that a negative test one day could become invalid the next if the person tested stopped following the guidelines. The only protection is to avoid it, and testing helps us to find it. Others who took part in the special 10 a.m. meeting were Medical Center Health System President CEO Russell Tippin, Dr. Rohit Sarvanan, Chief Medical Officer at Odessa Regional Medical Center, and Ector County Health Department Director Brandy Garcia, who said she and her assistants are calling people who have been exposed to see if they're having the usual symptoms of fever, fatigue, and dry coughing. Garcia said each one of the 26 people who had tested positive in Ector County had necessitated calls to an average of 100 people. Tippin said current CDC guidelines are to test only those who have symptoms, and Sarvanan added that the big question is, when do we start mass testing? Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons expressed concern that the county would be getting into the health care business when that would be better left to the professionals, but he voted yes with the other four court members after hearing that hospitals and clinics could be overwhelmed if the number of cases greatly increased in a short period of time. After Precinct 3 Commissioner Dale Childress moved to proceed with emergency planning, County Judge Debbie Hayes explained that the testing of Spanish-speaking people would be in Barn B at the Coliseum, while the testing of all others would be in Barn C. I think we need to get the wheels in motion so that if we do have to pull the trigger, we'll be ready to do that, Hayes said. Precinct 1 Commissioner Eddie Shelton said the best practice is just to act like you have it yourself, and thereby avoid infecting anyone if you do, noting that carriers may be asymptomatic. Although there is some consideration of starting to use a blood test, most COVID-19 testing now entails the unpleasant procedure of pushing a long cotton swab up the nose to the back of the sinus cavity. In other health crisis-related business, the court heard County Attorney Dusty Gallivan's report that his efforts to agree on coronavirus testing contracts with Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp Corporation had been unsuccessful because those companies haven't returned his phone calls. The commissioners voted to establish a coronavirus account with Clinical Pathology Laboratories, with which the county already had a contract, for $70 per test, and they amended the county's agreement with UTPB for nursing students to do clinical work at the health department, in addition to the detention center, where they're already working. The court also suspended all licenses issued under the game room and sexually oriented business ordinances and ordered the sheriff's office not to issue any new licenses till further notice. Extended Hayes' declaration of a local disaster, implemented digital recording to live stream meetings on YouTube and the current BIS site to 5 rooms in various departments, approved Human Resources Director Pat Patton's review of policies relevant to the health crisis, establishing essential and non-essential departments, personnel, duties, payroll, timekeeping, isolation requirements, leave requests certification, telecommuting, and equipment use. Falcon Giving Day, UTPB sets first online event Wednesday. OA News at oaoa.com. We've all heard the phrase, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. Taking on that spirit is University of Texas Permian Basin's first Falcon Giving Day. The 24-hour online event is set for Wednesday to support the Student Emergency Fund and the UTPB Food Pantry, Annual Giving Coordinator Danielle Davila said. The funds can go for anything from fixing a car or computer to renting a U-Haul or plane fare home. The idea is to inspire a sense of energy around UTPB graduates near and far, including alumni, donors, faculty, and staff. A gift of any size makes an enormous impact, whether it's a $5 gift or $5,000, Davila said. The goal is to have 250 donors give on Falcon Giving Day. The effort comes at a time of the global COVID-19 pandemic and the downturn in oil prices. We are very aware that our community is hurting. So many, https://www.utpb.edu/givingdaypeople, are going through navigating the craziest times. That's why funding is needed now more than ever, Davila said. We urge people to give and give back at utpb.edu/givingday, Davila said. When people contribute, Davila said they want people to share it on social media to create what she called a give-a-lange. The hope is to have Falcon Giving Day annually. Vice President for Student Affairs Becky Spurlock said the emergency fund enables UTPB to help students who experience short-term financial hardship. I think many people think of college as a carefree, easy time, but the reality is that a significant portion of students across the United States, and certainly at UTPB, have very, very limited resources. And so when you are barely getting by or taking out loans to cover your living expenses, and then something goes awry, often it all comes tumbling down, Spurlock said. She added that research, particularly by the Lumina Foundation, has shown that it's often very small amounts of money that students need to remain enrolled. They may find that their car breaks down and they don't have enough money to get it fixed, to get back and forth to their job, or to campus. It may be that they have trouble with food insecurity. They need some help to get regular access to food, Spurlock said. Spurlock said they work with students who learn about the fund through referrals on campus, or students can send them notes. We have a form students can fill out to say, I need help, and we have a team of folks that reviews that information and then goes to work trying to help the student. Sometimes the result is they may not know we have existing resources that can help them, or sometimes it's just a matter of connecting them. Sometimes they need some kind of financial assistance, in which case the committee reviews that, and then they'll get small amounts from us institutionally to help solve whatever their particular issue is, Spurlock said. Students helped by the fund are already there. She noted that financial trouble is one of the reasons students leave college. These are students that have already invested thousands in their education, but may need less than $1,000 to continue. They're already showing their commitment to getting an education, to getting a bachelor's or a master's degree. They've done the hard work of getting themselves to college and doing well. That's the hardest part. We want to keep them, Spurlock said. Spurlock said they see a wide variety of student needs, and I think when folks just don't have the funds or live very close to the line, it doesn't take very much going wrong before it begins to feel like there's no way to manage this, Spurlock said. The emergency student aid is one part of a more comprehensive approach to support at UTPB. We've also offered completion grants for students that are at the very end of their college experience and just need a little help to get over the line. We have a new partnership with the West Texas Food Bank. We've had a food pantry for some time, but this is going to allow us to serve more people with more options and more healthy fresh fruits. That's a wonderful program, Spurlock said. We have technology support on campus where students can borrow laptops. We have child care on campus. We have a financial literacy program on campus. All of our students learn about money. We have a medical services program. We have book loans. So this is one very important element, but it is part of a suite of programs and services that we offer to support students to make college more accessible for them, Spurlock said. She added that UTPB has had a significant response from students who needed help specifically related to what's happening with COVID-19. When UTPB and other UT system schools moved to remote instruction and asked those who could to move home, that created a significant need for some students, such as being able to have food to eat, transportation, and access to technology, among other items, Spurlock said. As a result, she added, the emergency grant team went into hyperdrive. In the course of a week, I think they served more than 100 students, she said. Spurlock noted that small gifts to the fund can make a huge difference. It's the little support and the big support. We need all of it to make the college experience work. Doctor, peak not this week. Surge more likely late April, May. By Michael Merlo, MMERLO at OAOA.com. While the Surgeon General warns that a coronavirus pandemic peak this week will be this generation's Pearl Harbor moment for parts of the country, local officials say the Permian Basin is expected to see a rise in coming months. During a Zoom press conference with Odessa Regional Medical Center and Medical Health Center, MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin said that the Ector County Health Department reported there are now 30 patients who have tested positive with COVID-19 in Ector County. Tippin said MCH has 14 positives, 5 of which are in the hospital, 4 are in critical care on ventilators, while 1 is on a different floor. The rest of the patients are at home, he said. MCH has had 73 negative results and 14 pending. There are 11 persons of interest in the building, 4 in critical care, and 7 are on a separate floor. ORMC President Stacy Brown reported that 75 people have been tested, 9 of which have been positive, 60 negatives, and 6 still pending. 5 are under investigation, and 2 are positive on ventilators. ORMC Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohit Sarvanan said that in areas of significant community transmission, a cloth mask would be a good thing to use per CDC recommendations. The CDC recommends wearing cloth face coverings in public settings where other social distancing measures are difficult to maintain, like grocery stores and pharmacies. Sarvanan said that the Surgeon General's remarks about a peak in coronavirus cases does not apply to the Permian Basin yet. If you look at our curve of cases, that is not the part of the curve we are in. That is specific to the exponential rise and the peaking that they are expecting that will happen in the rest of the country that's heavily affected by this, but it is not here in that full effect yet. Sarvanan said that without any social distancing, the Permian Basin would expect a higher peak at the end of April or May, but with good social distancing, that peak could come a month or two later. As far as what people can do on an individual level, Sarvanen said that although there has been a lot of emphasis on hand sanitizer use, soap and water still works best. Tippin said that if homeless people need help and are showing COVID-19 symptoms, then they would direct some of them to the Ector County Health Department into MCH care clinics, and he said that if things are bad, then the emergency room. Sarvanen said that he would also direct homeless to the health department and said that the emergency room is always open. CDC cloth face covering guidelines can be found at https://tinyurl.com/UXPHVL2. And the University of Texas projection model can be seen at https://tinyurl.com/VAPNAZ9. The Daily Press Briefing with local health officials is streamed on both the Odessa American and Medical Center Hospital Facebook pages at 3 p.m. daily. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County confirmed cases, 30. Ector County negative, 112. Out of 197 tested with 55 pending. Midland County, 27 confirmed out of 532 tested, 1 death. Texas, 7,276 confirmed with 85,357 tested. Total Texas deaths, 140. U.S. cases, 356,942 total confirmed and 10,792 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or cdc.gov or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Internet needs. Grande Communications announced Monday a series of steps to help residential and business customers address expanded internet connectivity needs, as well as mitigate financial hardships. Grande will offer free internet and Wi-Fi for 60 days to all qualifying low-income households who do not already subscribe to their internet service and who enroll in the Internet First program. The Internet First program is affordable internet designed to help families and students in low-income households to have reliable access to the internet. Grande will not terminate service to any residential or business customer because of their inability to pay their bills due to disruptions caused by COVID-19 and will also be waiving late fees. Call 1-866-247-2633 or visit www.mygrande.com. Internet First. Odessa College, summer registration underway. OA News at oaoa.com. Odessa College will transition all summer courses to remote, virtual, and online learning. Registration is currently underway, and current students are encouraged to contact their success coach or their instructor to plan their summer schedule. Future students should contact the Wrangler Express Center at wranglerexpress@odessa.edu for next steps. Summer is a great time for students to accelerate their learning and decrease their time to degree, Tremaine Anderson, Vice President of Instruction, said in a news release. Our summer schedule has always been predominantly online, giving students, families, and employers the most flexibility for summer learning. However, given the unpredictability of this virus, it is incumbent on us to make this transition early. Ensuring that students fully understand their options and are prepared for the first day of summer school. Odessa College is committed to returning to standard operations in the future, including face-to-face classes, once traveling and large group events are considered safe, the release said. Continue to monitor the college's COVID-19 webpage, social media, and student email for the most up-to-date and accurate information. Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, April 7th, 2020, OAOA.com. Staples helps. OA News at OAOA.com. Staples is stepping up to partner with Children's Miracle Network at Medical Center Health System to collect personal protective equipment, PPE. Donations of new, unused, unopened PPE, such as N95 respirator face masks, disposable face masks, face shields, eye protective wear, isolation or surgical gowns, can be dropped off at participating Staples locations. Donations will be shipped to Medical Center Health System to help caregivers during the COVID-19 crisis. Monetary donations will also be accepted through the Medical Center Health System Foundation at https://mchodessa.com/mchsfoundation/. Follow social distancing guidelines when dropping off PPE donations. Visit https://cdc.gov/coronavirus for more information. Only unused PPE donations can be accepted. Donations can be dropped off only during business hours at the Staples location at 4509 Navarro Drive, Midland, Texas, 79707. Endorsements. Duggar endorses Shelton, OA News at OAOA.com. Recent Ector County Precinct 1 Commissioner's candidate Haas Duggar said Monday that he was endorsing the incumbent, Eddie Shelton, in Shelton's July 26th runoff with Mike Gardner. Duggar said he had been having a lot of back-and-forth discussion with Shelton since the March 3rd Republican primary, and that he was particularly pleased with Shelton's aggressive stance on curbing illegal dumping in the precinct. "He is doing things about it, and I commend him for that," Duggar said, adding that he had disliked Gardner's request of him just prior to the start of the early voting to drop out of the race. "I told Gardner that he should drop out because he had been the third one to file," Duggar said. Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, April 7th, 2020. Death notices. Death notices. Donna Diaz, Odessa. Donna Diaz, 62, of Odessa, died Friday, March 27th, 2020, in Odessa. Celebration of life is scheduled for 3 p.m. to 8 p.m., April 10th, 2020, at La Paz Purchase Funeral Homes in Odessa, Texas. "For everyone's safety, we will have limited visitors. Arrangements are by La Paz Purchase Funeral Homes of Odessa." Jesse Ramirez Hernandez, Arvada, Colorado. Jesse Ramirez Hernandez, 48, of Thornton, Colorado, died Tuesday, March 31st, 2020, in Arvada, Colorado. Graveside service is scheduled for 1 p.m. Thursday, April 9th, 2020, at the Odessa Garden 2 section of Ector County Cemetery. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Alexandra Montoya, Odessa. Alexandra Montoya, 25, of Odessa, died Saturday, April 4th, 2020, in Odessa. Celebration of life is scheduled for 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., Tuesday, April 7th, 2020, at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Visitation will continue from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Celestino Rodriguez, Odessa. Celestino Rodriguez, 88, of Odessa, died Saturday, April 4th, 2020, in Odessa. Celebration of life is scheduled for 1 p.m. to 5 p.m., Wednesday, April 7th, 2020, at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.